At the Institute, we spend an awful lot of our time thinking and working on issues of meaningful work and how people in the city can bring them their whole selves to the office, leaving neither their ethics, their values, nor their real personalities at home. In that work, I'm often confronted with people who tell me they can't afford to quit, or even can't afford to challenge decisions at work because they have a young family or a mortgage, and they have to do what they're told. So I think a good place to start is to recognize that life's journey involves compromise and involves shifting priorities. I think there are some moral absolutes, but there are far more shades of gray. Working out what works for you is a journey towards self-knowledge. I'm saying the evident. But it's a function of personality, priorities, talents and skills, needs, ambitions, dependence, likes and dislikes. One of the other things is it depends on your own health, your own resilience and stamina. And last of all, it depends what stage of life you're in. So in the course of my working life, I've learned it's quite important to consider one further element, and that is one's values. And I think I would go so far as to argue that we most go astray when we neglect that element. So what I'd like to do this evening is talk a little bit about how we cope with changes in our working lives, whether these are conscious personal decisions or foisted upon us by circumstance, sometimes of our choosing, sometimes not, or sometimes just unpalatable work situations. And if I am very brave, I will also try to consider how we listen for God's voice in that. I'm not very brave about talking about God. So my central argument and lesson, and this is the spoiler alert, is that you need to put yourself in the mindset about the fact that it's not what happens to you, but how you choose to respond to it. And that's really important, because you need a sense of your own agency in the process. And seeing God's hand in that process is what helps make a difference with how you deal with a situation, wanted or unwanted, in career changes and diversions. Now, I can't do this without talking about some of my personal experience and some of its personal mistakes, because getting the balance right between the work and the rest of your life is something I've learned to be fundamental, but only after several serious mishaps. So some of the examples are personal ones, and I will draw on friends and colleagues as well. So my choices will be largely based around my own skills and ambitions and values, but I suspect you'll be able to take some of this and draw it in parallel to your own life. There's possibly one thing you can't. As Jonathan said, I grew up in the United States. But I spent my childhood intrigued by all things foreign. Perhaps I read too much National Geographic, or I had a kindergarten teacher who taught me French. So for me, moving around the world was intentional and quite purposeful. But it brings about some challenges that hopefully you will never have to face. It brings loneliness, and it brings significant cultural differences that are not always easy. So I was taught by my mother that my job was to leave the world a better place than I found it, and that I could do anything I put my mind to. I had quite a wonderful mother. These were very strong motivations, but they were also a real burden to me. I felt there were fairly high expectations. What I am telling you that is I think it's worth looking back at your own past to think about what you might have been told growing up about what was expected of you and whether you can find causal links between that and what you actually end up doing or how you react to what you're doing. It helps you decide whether to accept them as part of your personality or to try and change if you think it's taking you in the wrong direction. I studied economics and international affairs, and sometime along the line decided I was going to be personally responsible for the eradication of poverty in Africa. As it turned out, not many people thought students of international affairs were going to be very useful at that. They wanted agronomists and engineers. And so instead of doing good, I resigned myself to doing no harm. Like most 20-somethings of the day, I worked really hard and I became very concerned about my progress and advancement. And so for the next 10 or 20 years, I took the best choice at every fork in the road. This landed me in London and then in Paris. However, as I progressed, I clearly felt that something was missing. I had a great job. I traveled the world. I got paid to travel the world for work. I had more than enough money. I was meeting fascinating people. But I was in my 30s and I was still alone. I learned that the success, without someone to share it with, didn't mean very much. It's probably also worth mentioning that I went to a women's college in the United States at the time of what was called second wave feminism. We were constantly told we could have it all. Indeed, I left with the impression that if I just worked as hard as I could be tremendously successful. However, I also had the impression that friends and community and family and social life were the easy bit, and they just came along without any effort at all. In retrospect, what I have learned is that you can have it all, but you can't have it all at once. So there are two lessons there. First, I think you need to think about trade-offs between ambition and success and balance. And this is not unrelated to understanding your own physical and mental resilience. Some things do come at a cost. They may be worth it, but you have to recognize that. Second, as Ecclesiastes tells us in chapter 3, there is a time for everything and a season for every purpose under heaven. Sometimes work will be your priority, sometimes it will be family or something else. But it is important to consciously think about what your priorities are and whether the sacrifices you are making for them are worth it. Now, shortly after this epiphany that success really didn't mean very much if you were all by yourself, by happenstance, or Jonathan might say grace, depending on your beliefs, I met a widower with two young children. We fell in love and married, and I was gifted with an instant family. We went on to have a son, and suddenly I had the family with three children that I had always dreamed of. It demonstrates a thread that runs through all my life: work, family, and friendships. I need very much to be needed, and that self-knowledge is not insignificant. Because my husband was a widower, we promised ourselves early on that we would never take each other for granted, as we had no idea how much time we'd have together. That put work in perspective for the first time in my life. Having come first for almost 20 years, work suddenly came second. I went to part-time work to tread water on the career ladder, and I apologize for the mixed metaphor, while our children were small. And here's a quick and easy lesson. Some sacrifices are just worth it. Just worth it. I wouldn't have done it any other way. Ironically, I was never so successful as when I didn't want to work full-time. I had less at stake, and I was better at doing the right thing. People no longer took my ideas as part of my ambition. They thought I'd had an ambition lobotomy, and so did I. It was fascinating as I sat down and looked and listened to opportunities which arose and turned down several which weren't worth returning to work full time. So this is a surprising lesson. My employer and other employers found me more interesting and more valuable when I was playing, as one might say, hard to get. I got offered a huge variety of positions to try and lure me back to full-time work. It's a slightly risky strategy to play that game, and you can only do it if you really know what's important to you. So I went back to work full-time when my youngest was 7, as I was offered the job I had always wanted. I promised to do it for 3 years, and I did it for 3.5, due to a bad relationship with an unethical boss who I realized would never change. I left to start a think tank on financial regulation, and I started work there on the day Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And everybody kept calling me up wanting to know the answer. And I was like, wait, I just got this job. I don't know what to do. With hindsight, a couple key lessons came out of these transitions. Each time I changed jobs, it was to learn something new, not just to capitalize on what I knew to earn more money. So I left Standard & Poor's for J.P. Morgan to learn loan syndication and loan workout, and to put my money where my mouth was in my knowledge on credit. The second thing I learned is I tend to get bored after 3 years. By my standards, that's 1 year to learn, 1 year to do, and 1 year to think about what's next. That's possible in a big company because you can change within a company. It's a little bit more difficult in a small place. The third thing I learned is that in this mediatized world, a bit of a public profile makes a huge difference to people's interest in you because they immediately start Googling. So speaking engagements, published articles, even blogs, or a constructive Twitter account can actually help increase your public profile in a way that makes employers notice you. The end to the think tank was a sad and sobering one. Our finance director took me a little too literally when I told him to use the company's money as carefully as if it were his own. He took it. Every last penny. And we found ourselves in voluntary administration, and I found myself on the street with my reputation in tatters. The board decided to pursue the man for criminal fraud. Not too long after the bankruptcy, I saw an ad that was looking for a director of St. Paul's Institute, and it looked really interesting. I went out to go for a walk to think about it and fell literally on my parish vicar walking his dog. I asked him about it, and he said I should talk to his wife, because his wife was a lay canon at St. Paul's Cathedral. What do you think, fate? Fate? I ask you. Someone was telling me it was time to give back for all I had been given. I believe that with all sincerity. Someone at the Financial Times challenged me on this and asked if it wouldn't be better to have been giving back throughout my career. She's probably correct, but I think she's a little harsh, particularly if you go back to my "you can have it all, you just can't have it all at once" thinking. And it would have been very hard to be giving things back while I was raising 3 children and working full time. So where is God and faith in all this, other than in my last very peculiar example? Both are sprinkled throughout my life in trying to do good, trying to be a better person, trying to help my colleagues with their tough decisions, being a good boss, a good mentor, and living my values. But God and faith are most helpful in taking time out to listen to what God wants for you, to try and understand how you can best serve God with your life. That might be creating a healthy, happy family. It might be running for MP, or it might simply be helping a neighbor or living a godly life in whatever you do. But that takes time to listen, a willingness to hear, and an openness to change and to God's call. The concept of vocation is not just limited to the clergy. I believe we all have vocations. It just takes some of them, and some of us, longer to find them than others. Until very recently, I would say to my children, I'm over 60 and I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. And they would usually say, if you grow up, mummy. It's worth stopping to listen when things are going well, when things are going badly, and when things happen you just don't understand. And this brings me to a second thought. There are many things that appear to happen randomly in life, but it's often useful to look through the randomness and see if perhaps you can discern God's purpose in what happened. The voluntary administration of the company I ran was without a doubt the worst thing that ever happened to me in my career. And yet without it, I would never have given my life to what I do now, and I would have been the poorer for it. Perhaps what is most frustrating is that such purpose is often easier to grasp in hindsight or retrospectively, and much harder to see clearly at the time it's happening. In a similar vein, I can't tell you how many of my friends found their calling by losing their jobs during the financial crisis. Few of them are earning anything like they were earning before the crash. But every single one of them is dramatically happier. And I think there's a really interesting lesson in that. Many of us will be living longer and working longer than ever before. Never has it been more important to figure out what you're called to do. A dear friend of mine, who I have known since I was 20, is now 64. He has just taken a job as a chief executive of a chain of international public schools. They operate in a language he does not yet master, though he's a keen linguist. This man started as a foreign exchange trader and then a private banker to wealthy people. But he always had an abiding interest in education, which he demonstrated serving in voluntary positions on school and university boards. He parlayed this interest into a brilliant new job, which I believe has the added benefit of keeping dementia at bay, because apparently learning a new language late in life is a very useful thing to prevent dementia. His example is a gold mine of lessons. Do what you love. You will enjoy the time you spend at it more than if you're doing something you don't like. Try to use everything you do to learn something new. You never know where it'll lead. Be open to change. Volunteering is every bit as valuable for gaining skills as a job and often gives huge psychic benefits as well. Think about where your skills can take you. There are no jobs for life anymore. All of us will be reskilling all our working lives. Think creatively about where that might lead. I was lucky enough when I was at university to learn a poem called Ithaca by a Greek poet called C.P. Kavafi. I commend it to you, but be grateful I'm not going to read it to you. The essence is that life is about the journey, not about the arrival. Thinking about your career as a journey and not as if you will someday get to the apex of it makes a lot of sense. It means a more manageable and more likely to be achieved definition of success, and hopefully give some time to enjoy yourself along the way. It also means living in the moment and not always trying to climb that greasy pole. Now, throughout thinking about this, and I'm grateful to Jonathan because it was really good for me to sit down and think about these things. I've tried to draw some lessons about thinking consciously about what you want to do and what God wants you to do. But here are a couple that didn't fit. Make conscious, not unconscious, choices. I think it's always good to have an escape plan or a plan B or your next job in mind. You feel less stuck that way, and if things start to head south, you have a bit of a plan. This can also be put as never get so comfortable you don't think about what comes next. I realize that's not entirely consistent with living in the moment, but I never promise to be consistent. I think it's also valuable to have people you trust who you can talk to about these things. A sounding board and comparing notes with others is very useful. I often tell my own children, who are now adults, that 90% of the jobs that exist aren't things they've ever heard of. When they're small, we talk to them about becoming astronauts or ballerinas or farmers. No one ever mentions being a credit rating analyst, a focus group specialist, a coder, or an events planner. And yet that's what many of the jobs look like today. Let me leave you with something I keep in my wallet, which I first heard in an order of service in the American Church in London on Tottenham Court Road several years ago. I find it very helpful. You go nowhere by accident. Where we go, God is sending us. Wherever we are, God has put us there. He has a purpose in our being there. Hopefully, remembering this will give you the freedom to do what you are made for and what God wants from you. Now, I'm virtually finished, but you get a commercial because on the 20th of November, we will be talking about this a little bit more at the cathedral in honor of the 500th year of Luther's Reformation. It's worth remembering he considered work an act of worship, because it was service to others, and serving others was what we were put on the earth for. So we're going to be holding an event called The Protestant Work Ethic and the Future of Work. And if you like this kind of conversation, I can only encourage you to join us. So thank you.